Okay, our final speaker in this segment is a man I had the very great pleasure of working with for a number of years in a number of different companies. Our first developer of the day, I think, it's fair to say. Currently working for Twitter, but he's not going to talk about that. I'd like to pass you over to Andy Hume.
Thanks, Rich. Thanks, Rich. Hello, everyone. How's my audio? Good to go? Okay. Has everyone seen this? Something like this? It's a website, but it's not quite a website because the font hasn't loaded. And that means it's also some other things, actually. It's also an outage. It's downtime. It's lost page views. It's lost revenue. Okay, any questions? No, maybe a bit more of a case needs to be made than that. Meaning is the baseline. Design is an enhancement. Doesn't that sound like just the kind of thing a mean-spirited developer, engineer-y type of person from Twitter would stupidly say in front of a room of amazing web designers and type designers? But this quote is actually nothing to do with me at all. This little phrase was coined by a chap called Paul Lloyd, who's almost certainly sitting amongst you now, the heretic. And he's a designer. He's a web designer. A web designer that understands what it means to design for the medium, to use a kind of crap cliche. And if design is an enhancement, then it's clearly not acceptable to get into a situation where meaning, the accessibility of content, is obstructed because the right font isn't available. So this is what happens in some browsers when they can't download the web fonts. It's downloaded the HTML, it's downloaded the CSS, it's got all the content, but it's not going to show it to you because the fonts haven't arrived yet. Because maybe the CDN is down. Maybe some firewall has decided to strip cross-origin headers from a font request. Or maybe the user was just on a train and went into a tunnel at the wrong moment. For that user, the website is down. And it's down because the web is unreliable. Networks go down, they disappear, or networks get congested, they go slowly. Some of them have to go to space and back. The web is inherently unreliable. But it's also inherently resilient. Things go wrong all the time on the web, and yet it still works. You send the browser some HTML that it doesn't understand, or there's a syntax error, it still works, it doesn't crash. A CSS property it's never heard of just ignores it. If there's some missing icons, background images, things just work out. You know, the browser deals with it. Resilience is what's required when things go wrong. What happens to a system when one component fails? Does the entire thing break and collapse, or does it degrade in a way that lets the user continue to make progress, consuming your website, using your application, or climbing some broken escalators? And web designers and web developers have conceived a technique for ensuring resilience in the things that they build. Progressive enhancement is mostly considered in terms of technology support, what happens to users who don't have JavaScript. But it's just as important, if not more important, to consider it in terms of technology failure. The reason we make websites work without JavaScript isn't for people who have switched off JavaScript in their web browser. That's a tiny proportion of web users. The reason we do it is to make sites resilient. Resilient to failure because maybe someone's gone into a tunnel, or the firewall has stripped all the JavaScript out, or a mobile operator has decided to compress the JavaScript and screwed it to the point where the browser can't understand it anymore. We need to ensure as little as possible is a dependency for delivering that content to the user, including fonts. We need to assume that fonts will fail or they'll perform badly, just as we've come to do with other technologies on the web. So in the same way we avoid making requests for JavaScript that block content, we need to avoid making requests for fonts that can block content. So let's look at a network waterfall chart, because every time I stand on stage with a big picture, I like to try and get one of these in somewhere. This is a really straightforward one, a simple website which downloads two files. So firstly, the HTML, which is shown in blue. Once that's downloaded and parsed, it requests and downloads the CSS file that's referenced within it. And when those two dependencies are done, it can start its process of rendering and painting onto the screen. Once it gets to that red line, it can start showing things. And this one's a really nice situation because there's just the two requests. There's very little that can go wrong. There's few calls out to the network. And this is what developers are aiming for when they wrap their CSS up into one file, deliver it all in one go, move scripts to the bottom of the page, things like that. They want to start render on the browser as soon as possible and as with few dependencies as possible. So this is a good scenario, only two requests blocking the path. Once you start throwing one or more web fonts in, you don't delay the start render time, but you introduce a new dependency that blocks the text render. You increase the possibility of critical resources being slow on the network or getting lost altogether and stopping your content from being displayed. And this is exactly what's happening when you see websites with missing text. There's been an issue with the network somewhere in that kind of area. And the page has started to render, but text that relies on a remote font has been left behind. It's only certain browsers that show this kind of broken behavior. Others do things slightly differently. Internet Explorer is the most conservative, the most resilient in a way. It never depends on web fonts to show text. And by design, you will see a flash of unstyled text if the fonts are not cached. The troublemakers are browsers based on WebKit and Blink. They have the least resilient behavior. If the fonts fail to download, you can't see the text. Firefox and versions of Opera that are based on Presto rather than Blink also block rendering when they download the font, but they also implement a 3-second timeout on that. So if the fonts aren't down in, I think it's 3 seconds, then they'll show the fallback. So the blocking behavior of WebKit and Blink is considered a bug. There's been a bug open against WebKit for this issue for around about 4 years, I think, which is great. But there has been some movement and conversation around it at the moment. I think Google are doing some work to try and figure out what the kind of most ideal timeout length is. So assuming that we buy into the idea that there's a problem here, what are some ways of solving it today? Web Font Loader is a open source JavaScript library that's developed by Typekit and by Google. And its goal is to provide more control over the way fonts are loaded and rendered on web pages. It helps you remove fonts from the critical path. It can also help you make the way that fonts are rendered across browser more consistent. And I'll quickly talk about how this works. A common way of implementing web fonts is to have a separate CSS file with your at font face rules in it. So this might be some CSS that's hosted by a third party, fonts.com, FontDeck. You can use this approach to embed third-party fonts. And yeah, typically you link to a style sheet using a plain old link element. This gets the fonts into the page, but as we know, it suffers from that blocking behavior in WebKit and Blink. So how would we fix that using Web Font Loader? First of all, you don't need the CSS link anymore. What you do need is a small bit of configuration, holds the names of the fonts that you want to load, so Clarendon, Clarendon Bold, and then the URL of the CSS file that you're at font files, your font face rules, I should say, are in. Once that's set up, you can load the Web Font Loader JavaScript itself. So the last three lines here, just they create a new script element, they set its source and put it into the head, and this ensures that the script is loaded in a non-blocking way. So, and this lot can pretty much be copy and pasted from the documentation. And once that's done and the browser's executed it, then Web Font Loader will start downloading the fonts that you've referenced without blocking the text rendering. And once it's done that, it puts us in a position to decide exactly how and when we want those fonts to render onto the screen. And the way that that works is Web Font Loader gives you access to various events that occur as the font is loading. For example, class values are added to the body element at various points in the process, which we can then target in CSS selectors. So while the Clarendon font is loading, the class value Clarendon loading is applied to the body. Once it's finished loading, it's replaced with the class value Clarendon loaded. That means we can do something like this in the style sheet. So the first CSS rule there would ensure that the H1 was rendered in Georgia by default while the font is loading. Or if Web Font Loader fails or there's a problem on the network at any point, once the font has loaded, the body class changes to Clarendon loaded, and the second CSS rule kicks in to show the newly downloaded web font. So that's really the most basic way of using Web Font Loader, but it's also the most useful because it takes fonts out of the critical path and ensures that you don't have this single point of failure when using a third-party font hosting service, or even fonts that you're hosting yourself. But there's a whole bunch of ways we can approach this problem as well. Web Font Loader is a simple way to get started that I encourage anyone that is embedding web fonts to at least look at if they're not already. But I want to look at a case study of a site that I've worked on recently. So color plus type equals brand. Does anyone know what this is? It's not Google, by the way. Somebody knows what it is. Yeah. So Eric set me up pretty nicely to talk about this earlier today when he showed a screenshot that looked something like that. And yeah, there's kind of everything going on here, clearly. What there perhaps isn't much of is type plus color equals brand. Of course, users love this website, and they're very likely to freak out when it turns into something like this. So this is a new iteration of the Guardian website, which you've likely not seen. But if you do want to see it, you can go to m.guardian.co.uk on a desktop browser or on an iPad. And I should also point out, mainly because Chris, who works on the design team, is sitting out there as well, this isn't a finished piece of work. The responsive work that's going on at The Guardian is actually all visible on m.guardian.co.uk, but we're only sending mobile traffic to it. I say we. I don't work there anymore, sadly. So it's a bit weird to be standing here talking about it, but if I say we, I don't mean that. Nobody really sees this unless they know where to find it. But if you're interested in following along the kind of iterative design work that's going on here, you can see that on m.guardian.co.uk. So this is one current iteration. It'll change before the old site gets switched off. But it's enough to give you an idea of the direction. And one of the directions, clearly, hopefully, is the emphasis placed on typography. The Guardian collection is a collection of typefaces by Commercial Type, here with us today, of course, designed 4 or 5 years ago, I think, which The Guardian recently licensed for use on the web. So The Guardian Egyptian typeface is considered a really important part of the brand and the distinct visual language of the brand, and there's real excitement about using it on the web. So our challenge was to incorporate these amazing typefaces in a way that would never impact the time it took to get the news on the screen, and certainly in a way that was never going to cause any kind of downtime on the site and stop people reading the news. So we looked at a bunch of approaches, some of which we implemented, some of which we didn't, and some which we may well implement, or they may well implement there in the future. Eric suggested as well that sometimes he feels there's pushback from developers and engineers when it comes to implementing web fonts, which is kind of disappointing on many levels. But hopefully you'll see the importance that we put on doing this and doing it well in a way that balances the issues of performance and resilience, which we need to deliver journalism on the web, along with the importance of carrying the brand through into the web products as well. So first of all, there were a bunch of requirements as we went into this. We know this one, never block rendering. We know that time to content, the time it takes for the news to show on the screen, is a key business metric for The Guardian. When page load times increase on The Guardian, the number of page views drops in direct correlation to that. Secondly, we want to avoid the flash of fallback text as much as we can, either somehow not have it at all or ensure that if it is there, it's as infrequent and as discreet as possible. Of course, we want to ensure that the data we were downloading is as small as possible, so highly compressible font format with as few glyphs contained in it as is required. We wanted to get them all down in one HTTP request. So our initial target platform was mobile devices. So latency on the network was a primary concern. And finally, once the user has downloaded them, we make every effort to ensure that they don't download them again anytime soon. And one last thing, the kind of calling card of progressive enhancement. Websites do not need to look the same in every browser, because it will never happen. So I'll talk you through some of the things we explored and come on to what we actually did in a moment. So Base64 encoding, there's a lot of benefits to loading fonts as Base64 encoded strings. For those of you that haven't come across this approach before, you can convert the binary file format of the font into ASCII text and then embed it directly into CSS as a data URI. If you've ever seen anything like that in people's CSS files, then that's what's going on. And I think the primary benefit of this is that you get more control. You're free to load the Base64 strings in line in your HTML, which could be good if you have a really small icon font or something. Or you can inline them directly in a CSS file. Or you can inline them, deliver them to the browser via JSON or XML if you want, because they're just strings of ASCII text by this point. They don't mean anything until you put them into a at font face rule. And because of that, it's really easy to bundle all of the fonts into one file. So Typekit do this by default. When you load their JavaScript, what they end up loading is one CSS file with all the fonts Base64 encoded inside it. One of the downsides of this is that you have to detect which font file format to send up front. You have to detect whether the browser supports WAF or TTF or EOT. You can't make use of the browser just knowing which one to download in the at font face rule. I'll talk how we deal with that in a moment. Also, you have to create the Base64 strings from the font files yourself, and there's plenty of tools for doing that on the web, but it's just another sort of part of your build process or something that you have to look after. But on the whole, the flexibility that you get with this is really nice. So when we were initially talking about fonts on The Guardian, I don't know, I was quite keen on this approach. So the idea is that you load the first page showing the fallback text, which is Georgia, I think. And then in the background, you start downloading the web fonts, but you don't show them until they're cached by the browser, the user goes to a second page, and then you can show them without a flash of fallback. That sort of turned out to not be a great idea for a high-traffic news site, because people come in, read one page, and then leave and don't come back. And so they'd never see the font, and they would have downloaded it for no reason, which is pretty sucky. This was a dumb idea, I think. Getting your font down to the smallest viable size could be really important, depending on the size of the font in the first place. Eric touched on this earlier as well. So in the kind of most extreme example, the Arial Unicode font is 22 megabytes in size because it supports hundreds of languages. If you subset that to only include a Latin 1 character range, you'll get it down to 36K. Now, in a lot of cases, your typefaces will only likely include Latin characters in the first place, but it is definitely worth checking that you're not serving any Arabic or Greek glyphs when you don't have any content in those languages. Sometimes as well, you'll find fonts that contain other sort of weird glyphs for historical reasons, if they were commissioned by a particular organization or company. The Guardian fonts have a few interesting things in them as well, a sort of stylized star and other things that we weren't initially going to use on the web. So we worked with Commercial Type to get just the character set that we absolutely needed in that font. Right, I couldn't be less qualified to talk about this topic, but this is our experience with the Guardian fonts so far. We had screen-hinted versions of the fonts, and they were 3 or 4 times bigger than the unhinted fonts. So the WAFs went from around 22 to 25K up to around 90, 100K. And we couldn't see any discernible difference between the two on any of the mobile platforms we were targeting, and indeed on quite a lot of the desktop machines we were looking at as well. So we used the unhinted versions, and we served 4 of them at about 100K. I suspect that there will be problems as we start to roll this out across, well, there will be, as we start to roll it out across more platforms. And people have started saying these don't look good on, Windows XP or in Chrome on other versions of Windows. So we need an approach to dealing with this, which I think if I had a hardline progressive enhancement approach, it would be don't send fonts to that platform. That may work depending on the number of users you have on that platform. If it turns out to be a large proportion, then maybe we can just serve the hinted fonts just to that platform. But it was very difficult to justify making the payload on mobile 3 or 4 times bigger when we couldn't, by eye, see any difference. We perhaps didn't get a real type expert to say we couldn't see any difference, but we made that judgment call. I think probably the biggest elephant in the room on this is Chrome on Windows, which even modern versions of Windows, which I think the Guardian fonts without hints render badly, I think because Chrome doesn't use the direct write technology in Windows, but there's noises coming out of Google about them fixing that. So hopefully things will improve. This is an important area, one we wanted to get as good results as possible from. If we're asking the user to download 100 extra or hundreds of extra bytes, it's vital that they do it as infrequently as possible. So the HTTP cache is a good start. You get that for free with browsers. So always send fonts with far future cache control headers, as you would with CSS or JavaScript or static images. That should mean, at very minimum, within a single session, the fonts were only downloaded once. Beyond the HTTP cache, we've kind of got a whole host of ways that we can store data locally now. One of the simplest is the browser's local storage API, which is basic key value store. It's really easy to use. Stashing Base64 encoded strings in there is pretty simple and might get you better persistent storage than the HTTP cache. That's the theory, particularly on mobile, where the HTTP cache is not altogether reliable. In fact, there have been versions of mobile Safari in the past where the HTTP cache was entirely broken. Nothing was cached. It's kind of outrageous. I think because we had these great shiny new devices with like the web on, it didn't really matter that the cache was broken. Things have got better now, but there's still a limit to how much a mobile device will stash in its HTTP cache. So you can use local storage to kind of work around that. For how much longer, it's not sure, because more and more people will start putting things in local storage, and then the same thing will happen. If you're feeling really brave, you could have a look at app cache technology, but it's extremely difficult process to manage and work with. It's not designed for anything like caching individual assets like font files, and to be honest, I'd steer well clear of it for this use case. In fact, for any use case, it's a mess. So putting all this together, what did we do? Well, we embraced progressive enhancement, and I think by some measures we probably took a pretty extreme approach. The first decision we made is to only deal with what we call modern browsers, essentially browsers that support window.querySelector and window.addEventListener. That separates browsers basically into two buckets. One bucket, which just receives the basic core experience, the core content, news articles, and the second bucket of more modern browsers that receives the core news content, but then with various enhancements, and the web fonts are one of those enhancements. So this is basically IE9 and up. Secondly, we choose to only support the WAF format, which again is basically IE9 and up. WAF seems to be the emergent format for web fonts, and that's where more work seems to be going as well. There's work happening on WAF2 at Google at the moment, which looks promising in terms of compression and getting another 20 to 30% file size off of them. The nice thing about only supporting one file format is that you don't have to worry about the other ones. You don't have to worry about converting them all to Base64 encoded strings. You don't have to worry about the browser knowing which font to download, which font format to download. Thirdly, we had to be able to write to the browser's local storage. So if local storage isn't available for whatever reason, then the user isn't going to get fonts. So you can probably sort of see where this is going, and this is how it works. So in a script element in the head of the page, we do the test for modern browsers, which leaves IE8 and below behind. We test for WAF support, and we check to see if the fonts have previously been cached in local storage. If the fonts are in local storage, then we retrieve them and write them directly into a style element in the head of the page. Then when the content is rendered, the fonts are available. You don't get any flash of fallback text. If the fonts weren't cached in local storage, then we don't want to block showing the content while we wait for fonts to download over the network. So we stop the font loading process until after we've rendered the news. Then at that point, we check if we can use local storage. If we can't use local storage because it might be full or the user might have disabled it or some other unknown reason, we definitely don't want to download the fonts. If we can write to local storage, then we download one JSON file, which contains four at font family rules with the fonts themselves as base64 encoded data URIs. So it's one gzipped, far future cached file. It's just around about 100 kilobytes for four fonts. And actually, when we've started moving to wider screens, depending on the size of the screen, we sometimes download extra typefaces which are used in the sort of more desktop style navigation. So there's, yeah, some sort of responsive font loading as well. So those fonts should only be downloaded once for every user. Once they've got the fonts, they'll never see that flash of fallback text again. So incidentally, if you've even vaguely followed that, because you're a developer, but it was a little bit vague, you can find out more about it. If you go to Google and search for guardianfonts.js, you will find a pull request on GitHub from when I integrated this change into the code base. And I was reading through it this morning, first time in a while, and it's actually a really interesting thread. It talks about some of the performance implications of doing this, the performance implications of reading from local storage synchronously, how it works cross-platform, cross-browser. And you can look at the code as well, because the Guardian's next generation web platform, as they called it, is all in an open GitHub repository. It's all open source code. So yeah, fork it and improve this if you think it's mental. So I'm pretty much coming to the end here. What I've described there has been on the Guardian mobile site now for around 8 or 9 months, and I think it's served the site pretty well, it seems to have. I've no doubt it will change in the future as they support different platforms or as browser technology develops. In fact, I think it would be disappointing if in 1-2 years' time we're still doing the same thing, because we want to keep moving the technology and our methodology forward. There's no question that web fonts are one of the most exciting things that's happened to web design and development in many years. The technology's enabled us to investigate more of this, you know, huge history of typography and the rules and principles and things that we're learning about today, and to figure out how they might apply to the web. But as we apply them to the web, we shouldn't forget what we've learned about the web's own principles of progressive enhancement, of accessibility, of failing gracefully, and of resilience. So thanks.